Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with stars, creators, and industry leaders on Broadway, off Broadway, around the country, and around the world. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Stephanie Ibarra, a longtime arts leader with a resume that includes the Playwrights Realm, Dallas Theater Center, and the Public Theater. Ibarra was named artistic director at Baltimore Center Stage in 2018. And she was in the midst of the first full season she'd programmed at the theater when the coronavirus pandemic shut down center stage alongside all the other theaters around the country. Now, with nonprofit theaters and commercial producers alike grappling with their own systemic racism and working to enact the changes that will combat it, Ibarra already has knowledge and experience that many in the theater industry are hungry for. In the wake of the 2016 election, she and a small handful of arts professionals founded the Artists Anti-Racist Coalition. And she came to her role at Center Stage with anti-racism in mind. Ibarra is in the virtual studio with me to tell us what it means, artistically and structurally, for a longstanding theater to embrace anti-racism and make real change. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about your background in the theater and what brought you to where you are today?
Well, the older I get, the longer that story gets. So I'll try to be brief. I started in the theater a gajillion years ago, a little over two decades, as an actor, and very quickly realized that if I wanted to effect change in my community, I personally was not going to be most effective as an actor. I wanted to be the boss. So I sort of made my way through from Dallas up to the East Coast and through various parts of New England by way of the Yale School of Drama into New York, and found myself working as an artistic producer off Broadway and for about a decade. Yeah. And ultimately
at the Public Theater, we should say.
Most recently, right. At the Public Theater. Right. And I learned so much being there in New York for all those years, and in many ways still think of it as home. But when Baltimore Center Stage called and said they were looking for a new artistic director to succeed my dear friend and colleague Kwame Kwarma, I could not resist. And so I've been here in Baltimore for a little over a year and a half as the artistic director at Baltimore Center Stage.
Right. And you'd worked with Kwame before, right? He was involved in the Public Works and things like that.
Right. And actually, he and I met before he did Public Works. We met 1,000 years ago at the Public when I was line producing Dominique Morisseau's production of Detroit 67, which Kwame was directing. And so that's where we first met. And then he worked on the mobile unit with me and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And the mobile unit, just for people who don't know, that's taking productions, Shakespeare productions to all five boroughs. It's basically, I kind of think of it as Shakespeare on the Park, except traveling. Is that right?
Yeah. I think of it as, Yeah, the community touring arm of the public theater, Shakespeare in the Park, in all five boroughs, also known as really close to the way Shakespeare was performed when Shakespeare was doing his own work.
Right.
According to all of my Shakespeare scholar friends. So it was a pretty amazing experience.
Right. And is there a job or an experience in particular in your career that really influences the way you think about anti-racism in the theater?
100% my time as the program director of the mobile unit at the Public Theater. Yeah. So the years that I spent at the Public were among the most formative of my career. And a big part of that was that my time producing the mobile unit and actually producing work for a community context and producing work that was designed to be performed in prisons and homeless shelters and libraries and community centers intersected beautifully with my own journey along the path of anti-racism. So I was getting to see up close the effects of systemic racism, white supremacy, and systemic oppression in our society, and the disproportionate impact it has on communities of color, and the devastating impact it has on communities of color. And I was seeing that right at the same time when I was devising and constructing, producing practices for the mobile unit to align with the set of values that we were aspiring to.
Yeah. Can you give us a concrete example or two of some of the stuff you did and how that was influenced by the things you saw as you were working?
Sure. There are so many ways that we as theater consumers and theater makers are just completely unknowingly indoctrinated into a set of behaviors or beliefs and practices. And one of the more insidious ways that white supremacy specifically shows up in our theater practices is this idea of sit quietly, politely, I'm doing air quotes now, whatever, and in the dark and mind your manners while, you know, the work of art is being performed before you, and do not disturb it. And there's sort of, there's a hierarchy built into that behavior system. And when I was working on the mobile unit, the model is inspired by a company called 10,000 Things in Minneapolis. And it involves putting the actors and the playing space in a 14 by 14 foot sort of square in the center of the room, putting the audience on all four sides, using the whatever lights are overhead, and no amplified sound. So by virtue of simply being all under the same light and not distinguishing, like by darkness, who is sitting in darkness and who is sitting in a pool of light, the hierarchy began to dissolve and disintegrate, and the kind of behavior that we saw from our audiences, the vocalization within the audience members, the community building that was being facilitated during the performance was proof positive that our physical spaces and the physical experience of going to the theater reinforces for better and for worse some really some traditions we should maybe think about doing away with.
Like the proscenium, it sounds like, is one of the
possibly. Yeah. But, you know, when we think about who is who our audiences are, you know, are made up of primarily, whether you're talking about regional theater or Broadway, we all know it's a very well-known fact that they are predominantly white and that they come from a particular socioeconomic status. Right. And when sitting in the mobile unit audiences where we were self-selecting into communities of color throughout New York, there was a different kind of tacit the tacit rules of engagement that we have in a Broadway house did not apply. Right. And so that is actually like one of the more nuanced examples of how just one way anti-racism work can show up inside of our theater productions is simply, you know, allowing audiences to come with their, as their whole selves into a theatrical experience and to not police or regulate or legislate how they experience that performance and to stop dictating what is the correct way to sit and enjoy theater.
Yeah. And it sounds like from what I know of your background, at around this time is when you started thinking about, and you're one of the co-founders of an organization called the Artists Anti-Racism Coalition. And so this is, it sounds like that fed into the work that you did that led to that. Can you tell us a little about that?
Deeply, yeah, this is deeply ingrained in my work at the Public.
Yeah,
that particular organization, or it's more of a collective than anything else, began like so many things right after the 2016 presidential election. Mm,
right,
and my friends and I took a training from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond called Undoing Racism and Community Organizing. Right. And immediately, you know, we were introduced to a set of practices and principles that many other people have known about for years, but were, was new to me and us. And it was a little like, I liken it to the movie The Matrix, where if you, once you unplug from the Matrix and you look around and you realize what the world is actually, how the world is actually operating, and you see all of these systems that are operating on all of us and within our beloved spaces like our theater institutions. And so it's really hard to unsee. It's really, really hard to unknow and unsee. And so once I had been through that training, it didn't take long for me to look around, for us to look around, and we could see the systemic racism, the unintended and accidental and unwitting participation in systemic racism literally everywhere. Right. So Roberta Pereira and Jacob Padron and David Roberts and I, we all went to graduate school together, so we're dear friends, and all working in New York theater in some capacity. And we started organizing. We started organizing and calling our colleagues in who worked in other areas of the off-Broadway community. And we took the training again with our off-Broadway colleagues, and from there really started to imagine collectively with our friends and with our colleagues how we could start to dismantle this stuff within the off-Broadway community. And that work continues today. And I no longer live in New York, but I'm still on those emails, and that's a list now dozens and dozens of people big, and they are still to this very day, they're talking amongst themselves about how to continue the work.
And can you give us an example of how you do that, or how you first started that out? What were some of the projects or initiatives that the coalition first kind of took on when it launched?
It began, you know, this particular manifestation of the of organizing looks like, it began a lot with conversation and just talking to each other about where we were seeing racist systems or practices or processes in our individual organizations. So at first, it really did look a lot like, hey, I think I found a racism moment. And, you know, and I think it's in this practice, in this set of practices, I think I see a white supremacy moment in this set of beliefs. Mm. And whether we are talking to, you know, we're talking across agents and artistic directors and directors and funders in that group. And so there wasn't initially one initiative that we were all working on, but instead we were working collectively to better understand all of the places that we were seeing this pop up. And the idea or the act of saying, I found a spot. Does anybody else see this? And everybody saying, ah, yes. Then we could start to think about and talk about ways that we might combat it. And I'm being a little vague here because what's running through my mind right now are just like it actually dozens and dozens of examples. One of the earliest projects that my colleagues and I embarked on was actually looking at the sort of 10 major off-Broadway theaters in New York City and looking at 10 seasons of those 10 major theaters and identifying based on our knowledge of the field, looking at directors and writers for 10 seasons and how many white folks were in those positions, how many people of color were in those positions, where those folks were being produced, which correlates to pay. And so we started counting. That was one major initiative when we started the Artist Anti-Racism Coalition. So we started counting and we started making graphs and we started making infographics. And then we started having conversations with some of our colleagues who were artistic directors and artistic leaders inside of the off-Broadway community to let them know what we'd found.
Which was, I imagine these were quite telling, these figures.
Yes. There was what was striking was none of it is malicious. None of it is. I got to believe that none of it is intentional. But what was really striking was the narrative that organizations had about themselves and what their hiring practices or curatorial practices actually revealed. Right. So there's one off-Broadway theater, a colleague of ours who said, you know, we're very diverse. We have a great diversity of writers and directors in our history. And then they proceeded to name, you know, we produced Terrell McCraney and we produced Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. So, yeah, we've been supporting, you know, artists of color for a while. And then when we look back at those 10 seasons, it was 90% of the content, the writers and the directors, 90% were white. And that was, it didn't click. And so once they saw the actual, you know, numbers and the percentages, the response was, oh God, I had no idea. We had a completely different narrative about ourselves.
Right.
I'll have more with Stephanie right after the break.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And now, here's more with the artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage, Stephanie Ibarra.
And then, at the same time, as we mentioned, you're coming into an organization. You're coming in as a new leader in an organization. Tell us a little bit about how all this stuff you were thinking about influenced the ways you looked at what Baltimore Center Stage was doing in terms of where it was succeeding and where maybe some growth needed to happen.
I really appreciate that question. I feel like there's a whole slew of us who have just stepped into artistic director positions in the last 24 months.
Right. Yeah.
And I am one of the luckiest, I think, in that my predecessor, like I said, Kwame Kwame, along with my friend Hannah Sharif, who is now the artistic director at St. Louis Rep, they had been doing a lot of this work for a long time at Baltimore Center Stage. So I came in, I feel like, with a different foundation underneath me than some of my colleagues.
And, an institutional foundation, you mean?
Yes, correct. Yeah, okay. So one of the first places I look when it comes to anti-racism, just where systemic inequities might be operating, usually if you look at a budget, you will find inequities. So as the artistic director, one of my major responsibilities, right, is to produce the plays and put together the production budgets. I am the primary driver of where dollars get spent when it comes to our productions. And so when I looked at the production budget, that was the first place I looked. That's just what I'm accustomed to doing. And sure enough, I found, unwitting, unintentional inequities. And in a practice that is very pervasive and well-worn in our industry. And that is the tiered fee system in the different sized houses in our theaters. So at Baltimore Center Stage, we have a big theater and an even bigger theater. And those spaces are governed by different fee structures with the unions. But in the case of Baltimore Center Stage, we don't charge different ticket prices for those houses. And so many, I think, theaters do produce second stages or off-center, whatever you want, underground, name the sort of second space. But what happens is the artists get paid less, the idea being that the theater cannot earn as much money in those smaller spaces. But when you look at who is being produced where, then you start to see economic inequality and a wage gap starts to emerge. And that was operating a little bit at Baltimore Center Stage. So the actors were being paid the same in both spaces, which is fantastic. It's the same work. Yeah. And there was discrepancy, though, in the designer and director fees, which, again, is standard practice in our theaters. It's not wrong, but the unintended negative consequence is that it perpetuates some economic disparities that none of us want to see. So, and it was it's a relatively easy fix, and we don't get to fix it all in one fiscal year, but my executive director and I have charted a path toward parity. Mm.
Was that hard to get, for instance, the board on board with, or other people in the organization? How hard was the buy-in to get from your team?
Not hard at all. Mm. Because it is, while all of us are dealing with resource constraints, we all have priorities. We understand the language of priorities, and you fund your priorities first. So in partnership with my executive director, in close collaboration with our director of artistic producing and director of production, we created a set of production budgets and parameters that prioritized accelerating increased fees for our designers and directors. And we did that inside of an overall reduction in cost for our productions. So like everybody else, we had to pinch pennies and what have you. But because we funded, we put stakes in the ground first around closing these gaps and then built the production budgets accordingly, it was not a hard conversation. And we were very upfront with our artists too about what we were doing. Every design team that gathered, I said, here's your production budget. You may be tempted to say, where's the rest of it? And I will tell you very explicitly, here is the thing that I'm after over the next few seasons. Mm-hmm. So when you are tempted to say, where is the rest of it? Remember that I have a bigger goal that is operating here. And every single one of those artists said, yes, I support this. Let's go.
Hmm. And then how did your anti-racism and equity thinking factor into your creative decisions in terms of the shows you programmed and the artists you programmed?
Well, you need only look at the first season that I mm-hmm. created to see how it shows up.
Which was the 2019-2020, abbreviated 2019-2020 season, right?
Correct, right. We actually didn't get to finish it. But it is a season written and directed by the majority artists of color. And so, again, you know, looking at the historic inequities of the way writers and directors who are white have disproportionately shown up in our seasons, one of the first, to say it was a conscious decision is truthful, but also it is second nature to me. It is not hard to come up with, six outstanding plays written by people of color and directed by people of color. So that was the biggest expression, I think, of my own values. And that did not begin with Baltimore Center Stage. If you look at my hiring practices and curatorial practices throughout my career, that is where I have, that's where I've been living. Mm-hmm.
And did your thinking also influence what the theater was doing on sort of a marketing community outreach side?
Sure. I again, really feel really, really fortunate to be surrounded by a team at Baltimore Center Stage that is deeply invested in the sort of ongoing growth of our own understanding around anti-racism and how it shows up in our work. And one of the ways that we do that is by looking at our marketing language, at the ways we talk to and the ways we talk about communities of color. And Baltimore is a city that is majority Black. And our audiences at Baltimore Center Stage are incredibly diverse and yet still are a majority white. So we are wrestling with that disconnect, and we are looking for ever evolving our language and ever evolving our understanding of how we can do a better job of ensuring that that Black folks and Indigenous folks and other communities of color know that we're here. And know that we really want to welcome all of those communities into our building when it's safe to do that again.
Yeah. You mentioned the tiered fee structure that was one of the things that you are working toward changing. What is another thing that is on your list of things to tackle or things that you hope to tackle in the future?
I'm hoping to tackle this question of shared power and shared leadership. It is much on my mind as I think about one of the ways that systems of oppression work is consolidating power, right? And the hierarchy that our organizations are all built on is working against our better angels. And so I don't have good solutions yet. But you know, it's like the first step is admitting you have a problem. And I have a problem with consolidated power solely around.
You are in fact an artistic director, right? That's interesting. That was going to be one of my next questions for you, is how you start to think about, because so much of anti-racism work is about kind of the dispersal of power, or kind of the decentering of power structures, right? And so many theater companies, either whether nonprofit or even commercial, they're all sort of built around a hierarchy of some sort, and that's sort of they it seems like there is a tension there that is going to be hard for a lot of people to solve.
For sure. But I think, at least in my case, I am surrounded by, on the my artistic team alone, I am surrounded by a group of people who will not let me forget that one of the that this is one of the central issues that we have to resolve, and that we don't, you know, one of the things that makes me more hopeful about success in the short and long term is that we don't have to get it right on the first try. That, you know, my team and I will talk amongst ourselves. We have a shared vocabulary and understanding of these practices and what we're aiming for. And we get to try a thing and learn from it and then try it again, or try another thing and then learn from it. And we are, one of our practices is iterating and learning and evolving. So I have hope that we'll figure it out.
Yeah. In your mind, where are some of the biggest blind spots in the industry right here, right now, in terms of how people are thinking about systemic racism in the theater overall?
I really appreciate that question. I think that often it is easy to look at who is on stage, and who is, you know, constituting the board or the senior leadership. And those things are incredibly important. However, I think one of the major blind spots that we're operating with is that a culture that is reinforcing white supremacy is not just about the white folks, the number of white folks on any given staff, that or any given board or in any given audience, that culture of privileging and prioritizing whiteness and celebrating whiteness, that is a thing that is done by every single one of us, myself included. We are steeped in it. We have been fed a steady diet of that mentality. If you were born in this country, then you grew up on a steady diet of white supremacy. It's everywhere. So we should be dismantling the power structures. We should be diversifying our leadership, and it cannot be just about that. It has to be about a greater and more sophisticated understanding about the way every single one of us is complicit in upholding these systems.
Yeah. You've been thinking about this for a long time now, but has the current moment influenced the way you think about these things and your approach to these things?
Yeah. For starters, this current moment, it's like, overnight, literally overnight, anti-racism was like in the zeitgeist in a way that it hasn't been before. Right. So I remember, this was before I got to Baltimore Center Stage, but back when I was organizing in New York, I had a conversation, true story, I had a conversation with a board member at a major off-Broadway theater, not my own. It was, you know, this is when we were doing our let us show you your practices and your history. And when I said anti-racism, the board member responded with, "Anti just sounds so negative. Anti-racism, it's just so negative, and I'm not sure what it means, you know?" And so that's where we were not even 5 years ago. Mm. And now I feel like there is a much greater awareness about what that phrase means and who needs to be paying attention when somebody else says it. So it has been liberating to be able to say anti-racism, anti-oppression, and white supremacy, and not have to then brace myself for the sometimes the backlash that comes with saying those words, and not to it's been liberating not to have to explain it. So what that has allowed me to do is go back to some deep and much needed self-reflection on how to advance my own learning again and advance my own understanding of my own biases and how I contribute to and am complicit in anti-Blackness and where that shows up for me and how decolonization needs to be showing up more in my vocabulary and in my analysis. So it's sort of helped. This moment is pushing me to do deeper work and move forward in my own for myself individually and as an artistic leader.
Yeah. Are there other people or organizations doing this kind of work in the theater who you look to in terms of making great strides and in ways that you appreciate?
Yeah, in terms of folks who are helping to educate us all in the field, I think Carmen Morgan and the folks at Art Equity are doing a beautiful job and have been doing this work for a long time. I also want to lift up Nicole Brewer, who is...
I talked to her on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, actually. Yeah,
Nicole also been doing this work for a hot minute and is doing excellent work. And then, you know, I feel there are tons of individual artists who are implementing this practice in their own art making. Oh, and I should say People Mover, which is a Brooklyn-based consultancy, a Black-led Brooklyn-based creative consultant organization helmed by Jeffrey Jackson Scott. And Jeffrey and his team are doing incredible work in the integration of anti-racist principles in audience development, in creative producing, and in facilitation. So Google them. They're great.
Okay. Yeah, that's great.
But yeah, I think that there are happily... there are pockets of artists all over the country, and there are theaters like Cal Shakes and Eric Ting over there at Cal Shakes, and OSF with Nataki Garrett, you know, Maria Guayanas at Woolly Mammoth. Like there, it's a whole movement.
Right. And are there, you know, a lot of this, a lot of things that came out of this moment, at least initially, were, you know, reading lists for people who were eager to sort of educate themselves, as you mentioned. Are there works like that, books or whatever, that have helped you and that you might point other people to?
Sure. I started before Ibram Kendi wrote his books, First Stamped, from the beginning, and then How to Be an Anti-Racist. I was reading Emergent Strategy by Adrian Marie Brown, which is an excellent resource in understanding not just systems of oppression and racism, but also the antidote to those things in organizing and movement building. The podcast Seeing White, which I believe was out of Duke, I think
that's right. Yeah.
Was really helpful as well. But really, I think Ibram Kendi's work has been seminal. And going through Stamped from the beginning and really understanding the actual laws beyond theater, the actual laws and history of this country was a really sobering journey. And then, of course, everybody should be reading How to Be an Anti-Racist or Me and White Supremacy. White Supremacy and Me, which I haven't read yet.
Yeah, Me and White Supremacy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And for people in the industry right now who are trying to figure out what to do next, what's your advice to them?
Start somewhere. Start anywhere. Google anti-racism, go down whatever rabbit holes you need to go down. And then do not be intimidated by the enormity of the task, because it is enormous and it will not be done in our lifetime. And it will take literally every single one of us doing the work. But if you start somewhere, and put one foot in front of the other, and you keep putting one foot in front of the other, then eventually you have a sort of system of practices and a way to articulate your values and what you see that I think emerges, right, from constant practice. So my advice is, you got to start somewhere. It's okay to start small. In fact, it's preferable to start small. We all need to be starting small with ourselves. And from there, we build out.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. It's really nice talking to you. Thanks, Stephanie. I appreciate
your
time.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Stephanie Ibarra, the artistic director at Baltimore Center Stage and one of the co-founders of the Artists Anti-Racism Coalition. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe and find past episodes there and on all the other pod places, including Spotify and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. I'll be back soon with another new episode. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.